Blog Talk Radio.
This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Welcome to Free Thought Radio. In this era of the coronavirus and pandemic, we're glad to be bringing you Free Thought Radio. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and I hope you're staying safe and well.
And I'm Dan Barker. This is the March 26, 2020 edition of Free Thought Radio. Today, our engineer and producer in the studio is Noah Gilfillan. He's with Audio for the Arts, producing the show in the Stephen Yule Friendly Atheist Studio in Freethought Hall, the national office of the Freedom From Religion Foundation in Madison, Wisconsin.
And of course, like most people around the country, our staff is working remotely. There's a dispensation for media and nobody's here, so we're fortunate to be able to continue to be in the studio just for this production. And Freethought Radio is the weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. We have two purposes, and both of them are basically to fight the virus of religion. Dan, you know that. We're representing those of us who are personally free from religion, over 31,000 members, and we work to keep that virus of religion out of our government. And boy, has FFRF and our staff been working hard this week, because there are so many public officials who are taking advantage of the coronavirus pandemic and consternation over it to promote religion through their public office. And we're going to be telling you all about the complaint letters that we've been writing from to federal officials all the way to state and local over their mixing of state and church.
So believers are free to believe what they like and to pray and to worship in this country. But we think our government should shelter in place, protect itself from that virus. So who are we talking? We're going to talk with Susan Jacoby today.
She's in New York City, and of course she's a distinguished journalist and author of so many books. We've had her on the show before. Freethinkers, she's done a biography of Ingersoll, written many excellent columns in the Washington Post and New York Times. She's hunkered down in her apartment in New York City, so we're going to talk a little bit with her about what that's like, and of course get her take on all of the infusion of religion into our government. And we may also have time to talk a little bit about the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage, because she's writing a chapter for a book on the role of religion in suppressing the suffrage movement. So we may try to have a little bit of escapism from the pandemic, which is dominating everybody's lives these days.
So we want to say happy birthday. Today is the birthday of Richard Dawkins, the scientist and author. He was born March 26, 1941, and he's going strong. He's still writing, still fighting for reason and science. And Saturday, March 28th, is the birthday of the philosopher Daniel Dennett. He's also one of the so-called Four Horsemen with Richard Dawkins. Daniel Dennett was born March 28th, 1942. And I reminded Daniel Dennett, I was rereading his book, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, of a near prophecy that he made. Let me read what he said in Darwin's Dangerous Idea, 1995. He wrote, "This is my reason for wanting people to understand and accept evolutionary theory. I believe that their salvation may depend on it. How so? By opening their eyes to the dangers of pandemics, degradation of the environment, and loss of biodiversity. So I feel a moral imperative to spread the word of evolution. But evolution is not my religion. I don't have a religion." When I brought this to Dennett's attention a few days ago, he responded, "Oh, no, I hope I wasn't a prophet. Don't blame me for this pandemic."
Well, so, he was trying to make sure that we would have reason and fact-based evidence decision-making in place if there were a pandemic.
So,
unfortunately, it doesn't look like that's totally the case here. But we do want to wish both Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett very happy birthdays. They're both honorary directors of the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
And so, into the news. The Freedom From Religion Foundation is denouncing the White House for its continued pandering to churches and for sending reckless mixed signals about resuming church services by Easter, which is April the 12th. We also condemn President Trump's opportunism in his overt electioneering with evangelicals under the auspices of discussing coronavirus precautions. So earlier this week, Trump announced that he wants to open up churches by Easter Sunday.
"I'd love to have it open by Easter. It's such an important day for other reasons, but I'll make it an important day for this too. I would love to have the country opened up and just raring to go by Easter."
And on Tuesday, outside the White House, Fox correspondent Bill Hemmer asked Trump about this Easter idea.
"Look, Easter's a very special day for me. And I say, wouldn't it be great to have all of the churches full? You know, the churches aren't allowed, essentially, to have much of a congregation there. So I think Easter Sunday, and you'll have packed churches all over our country, I think it would be a beautiful time."
And then later that day, from the White House, the press conference, he defended that remark.
"I said earlier today that I hope we can do this by Easter. I think that would be a great thing for our country, and Easter is a very special day for many reasons. For me, for a lot of our friends, that's a very special day. Easter is our timeline. What a great timeline that would be."
So, of course, in the midst of all of the CDC and all of the World Health Organization and every medical professional practically in the country saying we need to keep social distancing, there's Trump creating all this turmoil by making it sound as if he's planning to stop the social distancing so that churches can be full on Easter. That is a religious holiday that has no meaning for anyone else. It's about the resurrection of the supposed Lord Jesus Christ. And here he is throwing a lot of red meat to his evangelical and Christian nationalist base.
Well, he's the electioneering is what he's doing.
Well, and he did do overt electioneering because last week he also, White House did briefings with churches. Now they had the head of NIH, who's Francis Collins, coming in on a teleconference to a number of clergy, but they were a range of clergy. They weren't all fundamentalists and evangelicals, and they were giving precautions that we all agree with. But on Friday, Tony Perkins, who is that Christian nationalist figure who runs the Family Research Council, he organized a call with all the conservative Christians in the country, and Pence was on that call. And then who do you think called in briefly? President Trump. And he was electioneering, and he was, you know, it was so blatant. He was saying what he wanted pastors to pray for, and that we make the right choice on November 3rd.
So there was an electioning to his evangelical base. And he said, what he said to them, "It's a big day, November 3rd. That's going to be one of the biggest days in the history of religion, as far as I'm concerned. So we have to keep aware of that, because as we fight this virus, people are forgetting about anything else." So the White House, Trump, and Pence are really focusing on religion when they should be focusing on science. And last Saturday, Pence from the White House, during one of these coronavirus task force meetings, went out of his way to say that he had talked with those church leaders and he wanted to reassure them that they could continue to take donations. Listen to what Pence said.
"We've almost been overwhelmed at the outpouring of support. The pastors we spoke to, we want to thank all the religious leaders from every community of faith in the country, making the hard choice to suspend services, to have online services, even while those ministries are continuing to support food banks and come alongside the most vulnerable. And, of course, the chorus of prayers that is coming up from communities of faith around the country is making the difference that it always has in the life of this nation. One thing the president and I promised was to remind people that on the weekends that you're not in the pews, it's still a good idea to, if you can, to go ahead and make that donation, because all the ministries are continuing to play a vital role in our communities, and we encourage your continued support.
So here we have the vice president basically beseeching the American public to tithe to churches, to go to churches and give them money, because, oh, we're so worried about what the churches are going to do during the pandemic. And this is outlandish and so inappropriate. And, of course, we wrote him a very strong letter, Dan and I, and we did a press release about this. You can find it online. It's just wrong on every level. And the problem is that religion is getting in the way, as we're going to be showing you in a couple minutes about some of our other violations. Here we have this pandemic, and instead of our federal government, our White House, reacting with reason, all they can think about is appeasing their evangelical base and making foolish, foolish policy, as Trump would do in ignoring the social distancing and making it sound like he's going to encourage everybody to come back out in time for Easter.
Instead of encouraging people to make donations to real charities that are helping with science on this. Did you catch what Pence said in there? Prayers are making the difference that they always have in the life of this nation. I agree with him there. Prayer makes no difference in the life of this nation. So,
of course, our motto, coined by Ann Gaylor, our principal founder of FFRF, is nothing fails like prayer. And our message to pious politicians is get off your knees and get to work. And there's a lot of work to be done. We also condemned a legislative proposal in the Pennsylvania House this week. A resolution was introduced by Representative Stephanie Barowitz, in which she called for a day of fasting and prayer to repent our sins in response to the corona pandemic. It's a ridiculous proclamation. Hopefully, she's not going to get a lot of other people signing on, but we have seen things like this pass in the Pennsylvania House. It's all about the Holy Scriptures. It's Christian. We've forgotten God. This is why God's punishing us. And the most reckless thing that is in this resolution, Dan, is that she calls for a day of fasting and prayer where nobody would do any of their secular work. No dispensation for doctors and nurses. Everybody's supposed to just pray about their sins, and that's what's going to defeat the coronavirus? I don't think so.
So we hope the legislature will pass on that resolution. In South Carolina, it's the governor and a mayor. The South Carolina governor, Henry McMaster, invited a chaplain to say a prayer before a March 15th conference about the COVID. And so we complained about that. We want him to remain cognizant that as the governor of South Carolina, he has to defend the Constitution and not be bringing religion. And there's a mayor in South Carolina, Mayor Joseph T. McElveen. What is the city? He's Sumter, South Carolina, introducing a special community-wide day of thanksgiving and prayer. So we're chastising that. Prayer is a private matter for private citizens, and the government should not be involved in directing people to pray. Over to Mississippi, the governor is misusing social media. He has put out prayer requests in his official capacity as the governor, Governor Tate Reeves, on his Facebook page. And then he recorded a Facebook Live video asking the Mississippians to pray to cope with the pandemic, and then he led them in prayer.
And he was, he was holding a Bible. And this is the same, many of these are the same governors who refuse to close down their states. This is what their answer is, prayer, not social distancing.
And then we're complaining about the Utah governor making a religious proclamation. Governor Gary Herbert declared March 20 to 22 as a weekend of prayer and service in Utah. And of course, we complained about that as well.
And we've also just got a letter off and a press release going out about the West Virginia governor, who said yesterday was a day of prayer. And we also are writing all of the governors, they should be going out later today, telling them that there is no constitutional right for churches to defy the pandemic protective measures, and that they mustn't give exceptions for churches when they shut down the government. They have to be treated equally. We also are condemning the power grabs that are these opportunistic politicians who are exploiting this pandemic in order to deny women abortion care. That's the governor and attorney general in Ohio, and in where's the other one? Louisiana, was it? No, Texas, saying that there's not supposed to be clinics are not supposed to stay open. I'm sure it's Louisiana. So this is a terrible thing, because if you have an unwanted pregnancy and you're in the midst of a pandemic, can you imagine the stress levels? And then can you imagine worrying that your clinic is going to be closed down by your religious right governor? So we have also spoken out against that. We hope there'll be court cases over that so things will stay open.
So we're going to take a break here. Stay tuned. After the break, we'll be talking with the journalist and the author, Susan Jacoby, about many of these issues. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
Stay tuned for more Free Thought Radio.
I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no religious body seeks to impose its will, directly or indirectly, upon the general populace.
Let's restore respect for America's secular roots. Help the Freedom From Religion Foundation defend the wall of separation between state and church. Join us at ffrf.org. Freedom depends on freethinkers. Speaking freely, thinking freely. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and we're going to play some music and celebrate some birthdays in a minute. But I did want to add another state church entanglement, which the Freedom From Religion Foundation is monitoring and speaking out against, is the fact that the Senate, in its stimulus package that was just passed today, basically, and going to the House on Friday, gives $40 million for abstinence-only education programs. Dan, the schools aren't even open. And look at this giveaway. And yes, there is also some money going for bona fide sex education. They wanted to appease both the Democrats and the Republicans. But this is a boondoggle, and this is purely to please President Trump's evangelical fundamentalist base. And it's irrational, and we should all be indignant about that kind of money going to promote nonsense.
Exploiting a tragedy for religious gain. Another birthday. This Sunday is the birthday of the actor Eric Idle. He was born March 29, 1943, most known, of course, for his work with Monty Python. In his memoir, Idle calls himself an old agnostic, and he says, "Dust to dust is about right. We dissipate into the carbon atoms we came from. Technically, reincarnation is sort of correct. We get reassembled into other things." He suggested that he would like his tombstone to say, "I'd like a second opinion."
Yeah, it was so fun. I got those quotes after reading his memoir. And one of Eric Idle's most irreverent songs is a parody of the old Anglican hymn, "All Things Bright and Beautiful." The song is relevant now in the fact that few believers are giving thanks to their God for the viruses he supposedly created, or, as Idle points out, for the sicknesses, poisons, and poxes. Here's the song, "All Things Dull and Ugly," words by Eric Idle from the album Monty Python's Contractual Obligation. So that might be a comfort song for you. It's good to laugh. That was Eric Idle's song, All Things Dull and Ugly.
Another favorite wordsmith of ours is the poet Philip Appleman. He's a Darwin scholar, internationally acclaimed, award-winning poet, and a lifetime member. Are they afterlife?
Yes, several times over.
Of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Philip Appleman's cautionary poem, In a Dark Time, is particularly relevant today, not just because of the threat of viral illness, but also because of the broader threat, as we have said, of the virus of theocratic tyranny.
And, of course, he came up with this at the time that President Bush was warring after 9/11. And there's a little reference to the lights going out, which comes from the World War II, of course. But we're in the midst of a war against a pandemic, and we think this is a lovely song we're going to play. In a Dark Time, Dan, you put Philip's words to music.
The warnings come in whispers and in shadows. The messages are fire and black contagion. As prophets rise to chant their midnight terrors, and empires all a tremble charge their legions. The winds are blowing cold above the cities. And lights are going out around the world. Even as the preachers thunder treason and holy horrors dance with petty scandals, even in this dusk, the dream of reason beckons with its flickering bright candles. But winds are blowing cold above the cities, and lights are going out around the world.
And that was Dan, my co-host, singing this song that he put to music based on Philip Appleman's very moving poem, In a Dark Time. And of course, what we stand for at the Freedom From Religion Foundation and secularists is the Enlightenment, so we don't want to see those candles blown out or be given an excuse to be blown out by theocrats.
I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. Stay tuned for more Free Thought Matters. In a moment, we'll be speaking with Susan Jacoby.
Hi, I'm Julia Sweeney, and I'm an atheist and former Catholic. I even wrote a play about it called Letting Go of God. Right now, Catholic bishops are using their considerable influence to deny women contraceptive rights. Please join the Freedom From Religion Foundation and help keep church and state separate. You can call 1-800-335-4021, that's 1-800-335-4021, or visit ffrf.org to stand up for true religious freedom.
As Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker. And we have on the telephone with us today from New York City, the epicenter today, Susan Jacoby. Susan Jacoby is, you regular listeners to Free Thought Radio know, is a journalist, a prolific author. She's an honorary board member of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. She has more than a dozen books, too many to list. They include Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism, The Age of American Unreason, The Great Agnostic, Robert Ingersoll and American Freethought, Strange Gods, A Secular History of Conversion.
And I understand from Susan that she's working on a book with the great title, Up from Sanctity, Why Religion Holds Women Back. And we're going to talk about that, Susan, but first I want to welcome you to the show and talk a little bit about what it's like to be in New York City right now, which is the epicenter of the coronavirus.
Well, being in New York City right now, and it is, we have, in basically in New York alone, we have half of the deaths in the country. So it's really a difficult situation. I'm working at home. There's a special room at the New York Public Library, the one with the lions, which many people have seen, for writers who are working on books with contracts, and so I don't have access to my books there because the library is closed. So I'm at home. Right now, it's an odd combination of panic, anxiety, of knowing something but not knowing how long this is going to last. It is really more, it's worse than I thought being confined to my apartment. Like many people, I'm having trouble working. Not because I don't have the time, but because there's all this worry and distraction. Like I went out this morning I go for a fitness walk every morning in the park. And you don't have to be, you can practice social distancing and go for a fitness walk. But then I stop, you know, for my daily look for soap and Kleenex and things like that. And for the sixth day in a row, there was no soap of any kind in any of the stores near me.
Wow.
This kind of thing is, on the one hand, it's really irritating and anxiety-provoking. And on the other hand, it stops you from thinking that you could get this and die of it, actually. It seems like you can't worry about the worst and the quotidian at the same time. However, I think one of the things I often wonder how religious people feel about this, because one of the things this does is it's my first experience, really, of finding that everything I thought was true and to be taken for granted yesterday, in the space of 3 weeks, has disappeared. In other words, we don't, in normal times, give the slightest bit of thought to, you know, when we're going to purchase a quart of milk, or to how close we get to another person, or anything like that, or to getting on the bus. And suddenly, life as I knew it, which consisted of going to the library every day and coming home and stopping at the grocery stores and picking up whatever I wanted to eat that particular day, it's gone. Just as I think people must have felt at the outbreak of World War I, all of a sudden the life they knew, which seemed to be secure, was gone. It's certainly how people I've talked to who have lost their faith in religion felt right after they lost their faith, that what they took for granted as just a condition of life is gone. So I wonder how religious people are feeling about this. Most of my friends are not religious. A lot of my friends are atheists. Some of them are, and they can't enjoy the social aspects of religion, which are going to church and, you know, seeing your friends at church and so on. One of the things that the atheist movement kind of falls short on, it doesn't provide a lot of the social benefits that religion does. But still, for religious people, the fact that life this week isn't what life was like only 2 weeks ago has got to be a shock.
Well, and we are seeing how some of the religious politicians are behaving in the midst of this anxiety, and they are bringing religion into the picture, exhorting us to pray, to give donations to churches, lots of governors out there telling people to pray.
It'll all be fine by Easter, Trump says.
Well, Governor Andrew Cuomo, who is undoubtedly a Catholic, and whom I think about 20% of the people in America now think is actually the President of the United States, because his press conferences, I now understand, are watched very widely all over the country, because they are completely rational.
Right.
You don't hear him talking about religion or faith at all. You hear him talking a lot about what individuals can do and a lot about science, but you don't hear him talking about donating to churches, particularly since the state of New York is going to have a budget shortfall this year, which is going to be a lot more important than the shortfall of any churches. But I mean, I have to say that a lot of these religious, like the governor of Oklahoma, who basically, you know, has been doesn't want social distancing and is basically telling people, like the crazy president of Brazil, that, you know, that they can just go out and, you know, go to the beaches and all that kind of stuff.
Well, even the president of Mexico, saying he's religious, and he's saying that there's going to be a miracle. Basically, this is going to bypass Mexico because of his faith.
Because the wall,
he's not having social distancing there. I mean,
the wall, right?
This is the harm of religion.
Which instead of delivering supplies to hospitals, the military is still building. But I don't. Religious leaders, they are having services, virtually and remotely, and of course it would be wrong. It's not as though all religious leaders are anti-science. That's not the case at all. We have almost no cases of religious leaders in New York in any way being opposed to the scientific view of the coronavirus epidemic. Unlike, by the way, but then there are people like Jerry Falwell, who has reopened Liberty University. I don't know how many Liberty University students were on those beaches in Florida at spring break, but they're coming back from spring break. And this is clearly totally disregarding scientists and what secular and many religious universities, which aren't run by Neanderthal faith leaders, are doing. He's reopening Liberty University. So you do have this theme, but I wouldn't want to say on a program like this, is a split between religion and science, because there are plenty of religious leaders who believe in science and credit it and trust it in situations like this and others as well. And it wouldn't be good for us to say anything like that.
Well, they're believing that in spite of their faith, because the Bible's very clear. Whatever you pray for, you will receive. And look, since the 1950s, our country has had an official national day of prayer asking for God's protection in our country. And how well has that been working out?
Yes, well, I think Donald Trump picking Easter as his deadline, which is one thing, and believe me, loads of religious leaders in New York have already spoken out against that. Cuomo said something kind of funny this morning. You know, he said if this were over in 2 weeks, it would be a real resurrection.
Yes, that's funny. Well, you know, the White House, the Trump administration, they're sort of in their little own Christian nationalist fundamentalist echo chamber. And of course, there's a lot of people working under Trump who disagree with him.
Oh,
but he's setting the tone for our country, and he's giving permission to evangelical fundamentalist politicians to ignore CDC and WHO and all the recommendations for social distancing. So it's very reckless of him.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of the things he's saying are reckless, you know, such as talking about a drug completely untested for the coronavirus as being a source of hope for people. And, you know, when you see the scientists standing up, you can sort of see, you know, their mouths twitching, especially Anthony Fauci.
Right.
And I'm wondering how long Trump is going to put up with him when he clearly disagrees with him. But I mean, Trump never showed any signs of being a religious person. You know, he's only taken this up since he became president and has a huge fundamentalist consistency. But I don't think that there's a lot of consistency to the way religious people in general respond to this. I mean, certainly, I haven't met any Catholic or Jew I know in New York who, except there are, again, the fundamentalist aspects of all religion. The Haredim in Brooklyn, who played a great role in their part of that, the anti-vaxxer movement now for measles and so on, they've been having weddings in Brooklyn.
So, yeah, again, the irresponsibility.
And this is, I don't think it's a matter of what faith or evangelical or anything like that. It's a matter of which people in which faith take this stuff literally.
Well, I read that some of the anti-vaxxers are having virus parties, like they had measles parties with their children, because they think if they get exposed to that, they'll build up immunities.
And that's just child abuse. We are talking with Susan Jacoby. She's holed up in New York City in her apartment. We're getting the firsthand report about that epicenter of the coronavirus. And when we come back, Susan, we do want to talk about the new book, the exciting new book that you are working on, Up From Sanctity, Why Religion Holds Women Back, and maybe a little bit about this being the centennial year of women's suffrage. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more Free Thought Radio.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
Protect the First Amendment. It protects you. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and we are talking on the phone from New York City with Susan Jacoby, who's an author and journalist, freethinker, and has at least 13 books, and now I was working on a 14th book, and this book is being called Up From Sanctity, Why Religion Holds Women Back. And I absolutely love that title, Susan. So tell us more about
Let's thank Booker T. Washington. Let's acknowledge that I stole a paraphrase.
Oh, yes.
Up From Slavery, of course.
Up From Slavery. So tell us more about the book and what's prompted you to write it.
Okay, well, I think actually the title is very self-explanatory, and it starts in ancient times, but this book isn't going to be published for about a year, again, thanks to the coronavirus, because I don't know if you're aware, but the publishing industry now is basically shut down. New York is the center of the publishing industry, and Andrew Cuomo has decreed that all non-essential businesses be shut, so that reporters and writers who have books out right now, being published right now, are really in the soup. They can't travel to promote them, and the publishers can't ship them, and so on. In fact, I would urge, before I start tooting my own horn, I would urge people who are bored and sheltering in place, take a look on Amazon at women's suffrage and the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage and African-American women's suffrage, too. There were a lot of books published this spring,
yes,
which are going nowhere because basically everything else is being lost. And one of the subjects that is being lost is the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage. I think it's going to have to be like the Olympics. We're going to have to celebrate this, really, the 101st. And, hey, why not? When you think about how long women waited to get the vote,
yes,
there's nothing so bad about waiting another year to properly celebrate it. Now, I think when we talk about, certainly there'll be something about this. There was something about it in Freethinkers, too, but not nearly enough. We have to acknowledge that the 19th century and early 20th century women's suffrage movement was very infected by racism. I'll just read you one quote. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things I consider different from religion than should be, and free thought and atheism, is that you don't cover up the flaws of your heroes. When the 15th Amendment, which gave former male slaves the right to vote, was passed, feminists and the first generation feminists who started at Seneca Falls were very bitter. And this is what Elizabeth Cady Stanton said in 1869. Think of Patrick and Sambo and Young Tongue, who do not know the difference between a monarchy and a republic, who cannot read the Declaration of Independence or Webster's spelling book, making laws for Lucretia Mott, Ernestine Rose, and Anna E. Dickinson. Well, I mean, you notice Stanton didn't mention either Harriet Tubman or Sojourner Truth, who had spoken passionately for many years on behalf of women's rights as well as against slavery. Now, it's a complicated story. There was a split between the feminists and the white male abolitionists whom they supported about this, because the white male abolitionists thought, and indeed this was true, it was very unlikely that an amendment giving former slaves the vote would pass. It included women. It was more controversial. Religion comes into this story later on, when Stanton basically got erased from the history of the women's movement for a long time, until the second wave of feminism in the 1960s and 70s, because she was anti-religious, and religious feminists thought that getting the suffrage movement mixed up with atheism would doom it, and would also doom any male support.
And because she edited the Woman's Bible, you're talking
and,
about.
And when she edited the Woman's Bible, she was basically banned from public, she wasn't there when the amendment giving, her descendants weren't there, and she had lots of them, weren't there. And when the right to vote amendment for women was signed. And there's something that should be mentioned about African-American women, too, that they were given second-class status by both white women freethinkers and white men. Ida Barnett Wells, the great crusading journalist, who founded in 1913 the first black women's club in Chicago, solely dedicated to the cause of woman suffrage, black and white. In 1913, she marched in a famous, before World War I, pro-woman suffrage parade. And she was one of the few black women who refused to march at the back of the parade as the white women had demanded. So, I mean, I think we've got to realize that that in our own historical house, there's a lot there that unlike people who take the Bible literally and won't hear a word against any religious person or anything like that, we've got to acknowledge that the origins of our movement were human beings who often made mistakes.
But with a free thought mindset, we can acknowledge it, we can apologize, and we can attempt to correct those mistakes as we progress forward.
Yeah, acknowledging it is the important part of it. It doesn't any more than the fact that W.E.B. Du Bois had some economic ideas I don't agree with makes him not a genius. It doesn't make Elizabeth Cady Stanton not a great woman suffrage or a great feminist, but it is a blot on her record, and it is something that is part of the history of American free thought. Robert Ingersoll, a man, was one of the few late 19th century free thinkers who was not tainted by racism and anti-immigrant thoughts, by the way.
And you wrote a book about him.
But I do have to say, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, of course, Susan B. Anthony, the early suffragists who were not religious or nonconformists, started as abolitionists. So we're not talking about people
yes.
that were fundamentally...
Yes. And that's why they were so bitter when women were left out of the amendment in 1870, because they had started as abolitionists. Yes, they had a reason for what they did. They were abandoned by white guys like William Lloyd Garrison.
So you also, we'd love to talk more about the women's suffrage, and of course you know we were trying to do a convention about it, a conference in August that looks like it's going to be have to be delayed, and you're going to speak at the next one.
But it'll be just as good if it's delayed. You know what? I can even see the ad line. More people will come. People will be crazy to discuss other important topics that aren't the coronavirus in another 9 months to a year. You say, you know, women waited X years for suffrage. We can wait one more year to talk about the whole history. And, you know, the things I was talking about, like those blots on the women's suffrage movement, the inadequate coverage of African-American women, which is being remedied now, that we can do that. We can deal with that.
Well,
we're not like Jerry Falwell. We don't
right.
reopen Liberty University.
We were Professor Chris Cameron was going to be coming and talking about African American free thinkers and feminist suffrage movement, and we'll reorganize that conference and let everybody know about it. And maybe your book will be out by then. Your new book, with that working title, it's a lovely title: "Up from Sanctity: Why Religion Holds Women Back." And I think we just have 45 seconds left. Any parting words for us, Susan Jacoby?
Yes. Keep the faith in free thinking and scientific evidence.
Well said. Yes, keep the faith and confidence in each other if we can just not be led astray by irrational beliefs.
Well, and also, Susan, keep your health. So we're
yes.
hoping you're staying safe.
We're doing everything we yeah. can as long as there's soap on the shelves.
Well,
wow.
Thank you, Susan Jacoby, journalist, author. And that's our show for today. We want to thank our engineer and producer, Noah Gilfillan. The show is recorded in the Stephen Yohl Friendly Atheist Studio. We want to give a shout-out to listeners in Philadelphia to WOOM, in Madison, Wisconsin, to WID, and also to WMUU, Janesville, Wisconsin, WADR Community Radio. Hello to listeners in Central Texas, to KEOS, and in Central Missouri, to KOPN. Over in Vermont and New Hampshire, WOOL Black Sheep Radio. And greetings to listeners to WRFI in Ithaca and Watkins Glen, New York. And, of course, all you thousands of podcast listeners. Find out more about Freethought Radio at ffrf.org/radio.
And we do think that freedom depends on free thinkers. It depends on keeping religion out of our government so reason can prevail. So we would love to have your support of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. If you're already a member, thank you. And if you're not, we would love to have you join us at ffrf.org. You can also click on the link to ask for information, and we will try to send that out as soon as we can, or look at our website. Tune in next week for more Rational Radio and Blasphemous Broadcasting.
Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
I hope someday you'll join. This is the news in brief from the United Nations. In the Philippines, a temporary ceasefire called by the Communist Party of the Philippines with the national government has been welcomed by the UN Secretary General. The ceasefire announced Tuesday follows an appeal by Antonio Guterres for a global downing of weapons to facilitate the worldwide response to COVID-19. In a statement, Mr. Guterres encouraged both parties to reach a lasting political solution and end their long-standing conflict. The Secretary General added that he hoped their gesture might serve as an example across the world to silence the guns and come together as we face the global threat of the new coronavirus. Massive investment in the trillions of dollars is needed from the world's richest nations to keep economies afloat in the face of the COVID-19 pandemic. That's the message from Antonio Guterres as world leaders from the so-called G20 major economies hold an emergency virtual summit on Thursday to discuss the coronavirus. Ahead of the video conference, which is being hosted by Saudi Arabia, Mr. Guterres on Wednesday launched a $2 billion global humanitarian response plan to help those most at risk from the coronavirus outbreak. More than 450,000 people worldwide have been infected and more than 20,000 have died to date. In an interview with Euronews, the UN chief called for countries to take more aggressive action against the spread of the virus by testing potential cases, tracing contacts of patients, and enforcing strict lockdowns where necessary. We need to break the rising curve of infections, he said, and mobilize a double-digit percentage of the global economy to create one that is more inclusive and sustainable in future. Developed countries should act in a more coordinated way to support people and businesses, Mr. Guterres said, before calling for around $2.5 to $3 trillion from G20 states to help developing countries do the same. And finally, the UN Secretary General has condemned an attack in Kabul, Afghanistan, on a Sikh Hindu temple, which killed and injured dozens of civilians. Wednesday's attack was carried out by Islamic State extremists, according to the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, UNAMA, which said that the group had also slain 34 people in the capital earlier this month. The UN mission has reported a mounting number of incidents against civilians in the last 3.5 weeks, with more than 100 killed and many more injured. The Taliban has been responsible for a high number of civilian casualties too, mainly from explosive devices and targeted killings, UNAMA said. And although the mission has noted fewer civilian casualties attributed to Afghan National Security Forces, it highlighted incidents such as the 21st of March Afghan Air Force strike in Kunduz, which killed 11 people, mainly women and children. In a statement condemning the latest violence, Mr. Guterres said that attacks against civilians are unacceptable, and those who carry out such crimes must be held accountable. He added that the United Nations stands in solidarity with the people and the government of Afghanistan and will continue supporting efforts to bring peace to their country. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
All right, good afternoon. The Secretary General addressed the G20's virtual summit on the COVID-19 pandemic this morning. He told G20 leaders that we are at war with a virus and not winning it. With an exponential growth in cases, the Secretary General said the world needs a wartime plan to fight the pandemic. For this, he stressed that solidarity is essential among the G20 and with developing worlds, including countries in conflict, which is why he issued a call earlier this week for a global ceasefire. The Secretary General called for three critical areas for concerted action by the G20. First, he underscored that COVID transmission must be pressed as quickly as possible, which requires a coordinated G20 response mechanism guided by the World Health Organization. He also appealed for the waiving of sanctions that can undermine countries' capacity to respond to this pandemic. Second, he said we must work together to minimize the social and economic impact. What we face today, he said, is not a banking crisis like the one in 2008. It is a human crisis. Third, the Secretary General emphasized that we must work together now to set the stage for a recovery that builds a more sustainable, inclusive, and equitable economy guided by our shared promise, the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. The full remarks were shared with you this morning. Turning now to a few country-specific issues related to COVID, and I can tell you that we are, of course, deeply concerned about the potential impact of the virus on millions of people across Syria, and particularly over the over 900,000 people who remain displaced due to hostilities since December 1st in the country's northwest. According to the World Health Organization, the displaced live in conditions that make them particularly vulnerable to respiratory infections. Besides overcrowding, they also face physical and mental stress and deprivation due to a lack of housing, food, and clean water. There are currently over 6 million internally displaced people throughout the country. WHO is responding across Syria. It is prioritizing prevention and preparedness and risk communication by supporting health responders to detect, diagnose, and prevent spread, surveillance of entry points, provision of protective equipment, and training of health workers. Across the country, efforts are being accelerated to prepare laboratories and isolation wards to inform the public. Health facilities and selected intensive care units are being prepared, and communities most at risk have been identified. A particular focus has been given to the northwest of the country, where WHO is shipping in additional ventilators and personal protective equipment to better cope with the strain on healthcare. The UN, turning to Libya, we of course very worried about the confirmation of the first COVID-19 case in the country. The health and safety of all people in Libya, including 345,000 of the most vulnerable, is at risk. A possible outbreak could overwhelm the already stretched humanitarian capacity. The United Nations is supporting Libyan authorities in the COVID preparedness and response efforts, but funding is urgently required so that a national and UN health sector's response plans can be implemented. Sustaining funding for the Libyan humanitarian response plan for COVID-19 pandemic is critical to ensure that existing vulnerabilities are not exacerbated and life-saving needs are addressed. The UN is also alarmed that hostilities have continued in and around Tripoli despite the recent announced humanitarian pause. And in a statement issued today, Leila Zerugi, the head of the peacekeeping mission in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, echoed the Secretary General's call for a global ceasefire. She said the country needs peace and security more than ever to ensure that health services and humanitarian assistance reach all those who need it. And Ms. Zerugi also reiterated the UN is fully mobilized to support efforts of the Congolese authorities to protect the population. Turning to India, the UN resident coordinator in India, Renata Desalian, welcomed Prime Minister Modi's strategy for a nationwide 21-day lockdown to curtail the spread of the virus. The UN system in India is fully mobilized and ready to further step up the support of the government of India to fight COVID-19, she said, Ms. Desalian, adding that she believed that if we work together, we can overcome one of the greatest health threats of our lifetime. UN agencies are working with the government on preparedness and response measures, disease surveillance, lab and research protocols, risk communication, training on infection prevention and control and cluster containment plans, as well as surveillance and tracking of travelers. The UN in India remains active and is determined to deliver for the people they serve, especially the most vulnerable and disadvantaged, who may be among the hardest hit. And in South Sudan, where there are no confirmed cases of COVID-19, according to the World Health Organization, the UN team on the ground is working with authorities to mobilize the resources to strengthen the national capacity to respond to the COVID-19, including both immediate health priorities and possible social and economic impact. The Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs and WHO are helping with national and local coordination, planning and monitoring, while UNICEF is working on infection prevention, control risk and communication, and community engagement. WHO teams are also helping governments with surveillance, rapid response capacity, and case investigation. A laboratory with capacity to test COVID-19 has just been set up. The UN has also supported the construction of a multi-purpose infectious disease unit to isolate and treat suspected cases. For its part, the International Organization for Migration is also helping the government screening people entering the country, including the installation of thermal scanners at Juba International Airport. WFP and WHO are also supporting with logistics. And in Burkina Faso, as part of our work to support the government's response to COVID-19, UNICEF has enlisted the singer Smarty, a hip-hop star in the country, to give a boost to prevention efforts. The result is a video produced designed to share information that can save lives. In addition to the initiative, UNICEF has trained staff to sensitize the population on measures to prevent the spread of the virus. The agency is also working with partners to increase access to water and is accelerating the distribution of soap and hand sanitizers, especially in areas with a high concentration of displaced people. The song is up on the webcast for you. And in a note we put out yesterday, you will see that we welcome the temporary ceasefire announced by the Communist Party of the Philippines with the government of the Philippines on March 24th, following the Secretary General's call for a global ceasefire. The Secretary General encourages the parties to reach a lasting political solution to this longstanding conflict. The Secretary General also hopes that this will serve as an example across the world to silence the guns and come together as we face the global threat of COVID-19. And in Sudan, on a related note, following the Secretary General's call for the ceasefire, with peace talks underway, the Joint Special Representative of the UN African Union Mission, Jeremiah Mamabolo, urged the Sudanese parties to recognize the gravity of the situation and reach a comprehensive peace as soon as possible. He added the COVID-19 pandemic requires an absolutely united front to save lives and assures the country of the continued support from the UNAU mission. And in response to questions about the temporary ceasefire announced in Cameroon, I want to say the following. We welcome the temporary ceasefire announced by the Southern Cameroon Defense Forces on March 25th. That also follows the Secretary General's call for a global ceasefire. The Secretary General calls on other armed groups to do likewise. He also reiterates his call for renewed dialogue that will address all relevant issues in the northwest and southwest regions of Cameroon, and that will put an end to the violence and human suffering. He reiterates the readiness of the UN to assist the authorities and the people of Cameroon in this regard. And I was asked by a number of people a number of times about the NPT review conference. And I can tell you that the president designate and the bureau of the 2020 review conference of the parties to the treaty on the NPT are closely monitoring the COVID-19 pandemic and its impact on UN headquarters. In light of the rapidly evolving situation surrounding the spread of the virus, the president designate, following consultations with the state's parties and the bureau, has written to the state's parties seeking their agreement to postpone the review conference to a later date as soon as circumstances permit, but no later than April of 2021. We expect a fuller announcement to be made by the end of the week. And on education, the UN Education Scientific Cultural Organization today launched a global education coalition to support countries in scaling up their distance learning practices and reaching children and youth who are most at risk. The UN Deputy Secretary General Mina Mohammed expressed the UN's full commitment to the coalition, warning that for millions of children, the youth from disadvantaged backgrounds, school closures could mean the loss of vital safety nets of nutrition, protection, and emotional support. And UNICEF also announced today will increase support for the 145 low and middle income countries to help children continue their learning while keeping schools safe. Nationwide school closures due to COVID-19 pandemic have disrupted the education of more than 80% of students worldwide. And in a statement we issued today, you saw the Secretary General had condemned the attack on a Sikh Hindu temple in Kabul. And we also today wanted to flag that marks the 45th anniversary of entry into force of Biological Weapons Convention, the first multilateral treaty to ban an entire categories of weapons of mass destruction. In his message, the Secretary General said the convention has made an important contribution towards efforts to eliminate such threats. He said the international community must remain vigilant. He calls on states' parties to urgently update the mechanism within the convention for reviewing advances in science and technology and to work together to improve biosecurity and preparedness so that all countries are equipped to prevent and respond to possible use of biological weapons. And we are very happy to report that despite the ongoing crisis, we have an additional member state that is paid up in full. So we thank our friends in Nairobi for paying Kenya's dues to the regular budget, which brings us up to 74 fully paid up countries. All right. So I will take your questions if you pass them on to Florencia. Okay, stand by. I need my glasses for this. Is there going to be an outcome document of the G20? I believe that the G20 did put out a final document. As you know, the Secretary General is an observer and is not a member of the G20. For his part, he told me this morning that he thought the meeting was an important step in the right direction, but there's still a long way to go for truly concerted and effective global leadership in response to this pandemic and its impacts. No, there is no, James asked if we can get a video of the SG's remarks to the G20. No, I believe we do not have a video available. We'll release the text. I think I've answered Edie's question about the assessment. James, I've also answered the question about whether he's not, he's disappointed. I've just given you what he thought of the meeting. Yes, the Secretary General has called for an easing of sanctions. He believes this is very, very important in terms of getting the aid to the people that need it in order to support the health systems in the countries that are under sanctions, whether unilateral or other types of sanctions, and he very much hopes that these sanctions will be waived. It is clear that in this pandemic, as in any pandemic, none of us are safe until the whole world has come together and solved this problem. If the car long before the world's poor start receiving the promised assistance on the UN's relief plan, we'll get an update from OCHA if any pledges or any countries have already pledged money. But obviously, the UN part is a $2 billion appeal is a small part in the resources that will need to be mobilized by the G20 countries and by others to help the story. Dulcie asked if it's impossible for the UN Security Council VTC meetings to be live streamed. That is a decision that is solely up to the members of the Security Council and the presidency of the Security Council. They will have to make that call. I see what you are saying, James, but I can only tell you from our end that if they want the meeting to be web stream and public, that can be done. Yes, James, the creaky video conferencing system is a creaky system. The system is not only servicing this press briefing, it is servicing other meetings that are taking place. I think like everyone, whether it's broadcasters, whether it's the UN, we're all testing our systems to the limit, and we're all doing our best. We obviously are looking at what other ways we can take audio questions, but at this point, this is the system that we have, and I do want to thank all the technicians that are working hard from home to try to make this happen. As you know, tomorrow there will be a large meeting with the whole of the General Assembly, and that is also being prioritized by our technical colleagues. Yes, Pam, the SG did participate in the G20 virtual meeting. I summarized the meetings, the comments at the start of this briefing, and we've also sent you his remarks, which are fairly short. Does the SG support giving Sikh and Hindu minorities in Afghanistan asylum in India? I think it is important that the asylum regime, the refugee regime, be respected the world over. On the Security Council, it is their decision. We have to wait to see what they say. I think I have tried to answer every question that has come our way. Dulce asks, what are the latest numbers of people who have UN people? Let me get that figure for you as I pull everything up on my, as of today, there are 78 confirmed cases among UN staff worldwide. Okay, we're going to wait a few more seconds, see if there are any more questions coming up. All right, I do hope to be able to interact with you live, or at least via audio at some point. Take care and enjoy the rest of the day. And tomorrow we will aim for the briefing at 1 p.m. Again, that's at 1 p.m. To give some time for the member state briefing to take place in case it runs past noon. Thank you very much.
This is Matt Wells at UN News. Early indications from the economic fallout of COVID-19 are that it could cost up to 25 million job losses globally. That's more than during the global financial crisis in 2008-09. Speaking to UN News is Daniel Johnson. Cher Verrick from the International Labour Organization, ILO, explains how governments can help soften the impact for vulnerable workers.
The ILO has made some preliminary estimates to look at the impact of the COVID-19 crisis on the labor market. Using ILO's models, we've come up with an initial estimate that ranges from 5.3 to 24.7 million. So the figure of 25 million is what we have called a high scenario. But given the way the crisis has evolved and the further deterioration of the economy, this looks increasingly likely as a scenario for the impact of the shock, the economic shock on the labor market around the world. Now, just to put that in context, unemployment in 2008-09 increased by 22 million during the global financial crisis. So we are looking really at a crisis that is potentially greater than global financial crisis in 2008-09.
Yeah, and you also say at the ILO, the International Labor Organization, that it's going to cost globally $3 trillion or thereabouts, maybe $3.5 trillion. But I think an interesting question is, you did bring up the 2008 financial crisis. How many jobs were regained in the economy after that? How long did it take for the recovery, I suppose?
So one of the key lessons of the global financial crisis and also earlier crises is that that type of situation and that recession that hit the world takes a long time not only for the economy to recover, but in particular the labor market. And we saw that it took a number of years for unemployment levels to, you know, return to pre-crisis levels in some cases.
Sure. And before we get onto the policy recommendations from the ILO to help cushion the blow, maybe you could tell me how and which sectors really are going to suffer. I mean, you mentioned in the report that self-employees, particularly in developing countries, are going to suffer because there's a lot of restrictions of the movement on people, for example, and the movement of goods, as you've already said. So how are they going to cope in the meantime?
That's right. So we see, you know, a number of vulnerabilities, you know, in terms of sectors. Of course, they're not only the issues in the manufacturing sector, which we saw early on when the crisis started in China, but what we see now is strong impact on the service sector. So given the constraints to the movement of people and how we're working, the border closures, the quarantine measures, which are all, of course, necessary to contain the spread of the pandemic, but these are putting major brakes on the way we consume, and it's affecting the service sector. So retail, of course, tourism is you know, suffering a very sharp and severe shock as we speak. A group that is particularly vulnerable in this situation are the self-employed, because the self-employed need their own safety net. Most countries are relying on their own savings as a safety net. And then in particular in developing countries, most of the self-employed don't have that luxury and they don't have access to social protection. So they are very vulnerable to losing their income and their livelihoods, you know, for a period of months, which will have a very significant impact on them and their families and really poses a risk of a deterioration in working poverty, as we've pointed out as well.
So how are we going to help them? What can we expect the International Labour Organization to do, and how is it going to do it?
We need to see decisive responses now. It needs to be coordinated. This is a very important message that the ILO has brought out, that as we saw in 2008-09, coordinated responses are going to be more effective. But we've also, you know, highlighted three areas that deserve policy attention, and that's protecting workers in the workplace, particularly from the direct effects of the pandemic, Secondly, stimulating the economy to stop it from collapsing. And thirdly, supporting employment and incomes in different ways. So I think, you know, when we look at the stimulus that is really being announced by many countries, is absolutely critical to ensure that the economy doesn't further collapse and bottom out. So we see this in forms of fiscal policy and accommodative monetary policy. But then really what we need to see, and you know, a number of countries have stepped up in this area, but needs to be done consistently across all countries, is special support not only to large enterprises, which are important, but also smaller enterprises and self-employed. So this can come in different forms. It can come in the forms of guarantees, subsidized loans, grants. We've seen in a number of countries already tax relief, relief on other types of costs that the business is facing. Because really the aim is to ensure that those businesses remain in operation and are there ready to take things forward once the recovery gets underway. Similarly for women and other, you know, all workers, we're proposing measures to, as much as possible, for employment to be retained. So these also involve subsidies and types of relief for employers to keep workers on board. You know, many European countries have different types of schemes, such as a Kurzarbeit in Germany, etc. Other countries need to experiment with what type of support they can give businesses to keep workers in place. And this is really critical because of, you know, we're talking about the service sector where some of these schemes may not be as extensive as it is in manufacturing. And then, because there are many workers who are not covered by regular employment relationships, you know, we have casual workers, we have other unprotected workers, it's really also absolutely critical to see what other support can come in the form of social protection for women, but also in households in general. And there, it's also critical to reduce the care burden on women, because in this situation, the extra burden is there in any case, but is being exacerbated during these times. So, you know, support on paid care leave, sick leave that is needed. And we see, of course, in advanced economies, but these, you know, extra measures are needed in all economies to ensure that workers, self-employed, women, etc., have that type of support during this period.
This is Matt Wells at UN News. Pandemics tend to affect men and women differently, and specialists in gender issues are warning that the COVID-19 coronavirus may hit women in negative ways that have a more profound impact on families. Women make up the majority of caregivers at home and in our communities. Existing trends show they have less access to sexual and reproductive health, and domestic violence rises during crises. But women have also the power to be change makers in the response agenda, playing a central role in communicating with their families and with their communities. UN News' Anshu Sharma spoke to UN Women's Deputy Country Representative in India, Nishtha Satyam.
One has to first establish that in any disaster, in any pandemic that we have experienced across the world, women and girls are the most vulnerable group because they're already at the margins. They're the last to receive a healthcare response or nutrition accordingly. And also in such circumstances, there's a disproportionate amount of unpaid care work that falls on them that further stresses their abilities. I think it wouldn't be an underestimate to say that any impact is far more of any pandemic is far more on women and girls. In such circumstances, usually there is also a very correlated increase in violence against women or in discrimination against women, and I think we're already seeing some of that unfold across the globe, and there's evidence from previous instances to say that this is how things pan out. So, just to establish that the impact on women is far greater and also runs far more longer, because they come into the recovery and rehabilitation cycle much after people who are not at the margins are. So I hope that answers your question. How long is it going to take? I think it's very difficult to see because say anything right now, because different countries respond differently, have different abilities to respond. And I think India, being the diverse country that it is, we're already seeing some interstate variances in how the disease or the virus is spreading. So I think it's very, very soon to say what will happen, how long it will stay. All that can be said is women are going to be very, very important as change makers in the response agenda, purely because they do lead some of these conversations at home, they're closer to children. There's also a lot of woman-to-woman or peer-to-peer networking over the telephone, and therefore they're a very, very good change agent for passing on information acting upon it, and also ensuring greater hygiene and greater health standards for the entire household and the community eventually.
Do you think the problems of the urban working women are different from the urban and rural poor in this crisis?
Yeah, I think there is a distinction between all these categories. I think urban and working women, now as we see that the home has now become the public space, right? Yeah. With everybody cramped up into the same space and public spaces have been more deserted. So I think from a safety, security perspective, I think lives have completely changed for urban working women. Also from an unpaid care work. Now, you know, we were just talking before this call, but staying back at home, even for each one of us, has just meant more demand on our own personal abilities to provide for, to cater to other unpaid care work, to look after the kitchen, children, the elderly. So suddenly, I think that the burden has grown almost triple over a period of time. And when you cramp it up into one space, I think there are also greater concerns of safety and security. So I do think that any instance like this distinctly and differently touches the lives of women who are urban or urban and working, and then rural women. So and I think we'll see some of that unfold in the coming days.
We're also seeing that a lot of, especially the migrant community, is badly affected by the lockdown, and many of them are women. So how's UN Women working with other agencies to help these women in the crisis?
You're right. I think migrant women, domestic workers, wage workers, or workers at the front line have been most affected by something like this, partially because of the lack of information or the time that the information takes down to flow to them. Also the fact that this also kind of takes away their economic franchise, the little that they had. And also because of geographical displacement, because many of them are not close to familiar or even home circumstances. That said, I think all marginalized groups are more vulnerable to be impacted by a crisis like this, not just the migrant community. UN Women is working in coordinating the UN's response from a gendered perspective, along with leadership with the RCO, WHO, and UNICEF. So we're now looking at three big areas of work. One is lending support to SAARC mechanisms, is how do we exchange information in how similarly built countries are responding to the virus. Two is how do we use the entire cadre of women elected representatives, because they have a voice, they have a following, but how do we use them effectively? And the third, of course, is women's access to economic empowerment, which is we know that a lot of franchise that or agency that women carry has been derived from their access to work and from their economic security or autonomy. And we don't want this pandemic to be to kind of take that away from them and therefore take away their voice, choice, and agency. So the idea is to develop mechanisms, tools, programs, policies that enable more work from home models, which means particularly, for example, let me take the example of a factory worker, right, who has not been able to go to a factory, not been able to congregate. How do we work very closely with the private and public sector, small and medium enterprises, to ensure that work continues in some way or the other and her economic franchise or autonomy is not interrupted? But again, I think we're all beginning to learn from each other at this point. We're beginning to think of a response plan. I think we're on our front foot. In just about a few days, we will have a gender response package that we'll be very grateful to then ministries and state departments who are willing to work with us.
This is Matt Wells at UN News. Well, in Mozambique on Tuesday, 14 deeply traumatized male migrants were rescued from a sealed shipping container on a lorry bound for South Africa. According to the International Organization for Migration, 64 other men on the truck died from asphyxiation. In an interview with UN News' Daniel Johnson, IOM's Sandra Black explains where the migrants came from and what the agency's doing to raise awareness about the dangers of such journeys.
We received the tragic news yesterday morning that the bodies of 64 migrants were found in the back of a truck that had come from Malawi. The survivors reported that they were from Ethiopia and that they're on their way to South Africa in search of better opportunities for their own lives. IOM Mozambique is in close contact with the National Migration Service of Mozambique in order to provide immediate assistance for the survivors.
Do you know how they were found?
The truck was required to pull over at a checkpoint, and police spoke with the driver, asked him what the contents of the vehicle were, asked him to open the back of the truck, and very sadly, those bodies were found. But we were glad that at least there's 14 survivors.
Thank goodness there are some survivors. It really does sound horrific. Do you have any more details about where the migrants came from? Are they all men? Are there any women and children?
All of the migrants are men. No minors, no women. We realize that these men were traveling from Malawi, and they're coming from Ethiopia with the goal of reaching South Africa. We have seen similar incidents in the past, car accidents, of migrants who are coming from Horn of Africa who are attempting to travel to South Africa in search of education and economic opportunity.
Of course, they're traveling down through Mozambique, Malawi, areas that were really, really hit by two massive tropical storms, Kenneth and Idai. What's the situation for migrants? I mean, it's tough enough for many in Mozambique. So are they not aware that conditions are absolutely dire for many in Mozambique on their way through to South Africa?
Mozambique is along this Southern Africa route where we see migrants coming from East and Horn of Africa traveling down to South Africa. We still in Mozambique have over 100,000 people in resettlement sites. The country is still recovering from Cyclone Idai and Cyclone Kenneth that happened 1 year ago. We realize that these migrants are looking for educational and economic opportunities. Some of them are fleeing violence, so they may feel themselves to be in desperate situations.
And what have you managed to find out from these migrants, not necessarily those rescued from the latest lorry tragedy? What is it they tell you? What are they looking for exactly?
The situation that some of these migrants are fleeing is fleeing hardship in their countries. They're fleeing poverty. They may be fleeing violence. They may not have the opportunities that they need in order to find employment, to support their families. So they feel that migration is an opportunity to improve their circumstance, so they choose to leave their homes. Many in this region, we see them traveling to South Africa.
So what's the IOM's daily work, if you like? What's your objective, both in preventing people from risking their lives in really dangerous journeys down from the east of Africa to the south? And how do you maybe get some people home, repatriate them? That's one of the International Organization for Migration's main functions too, isn't it?
IOM Mozambique, in cooperation with other IOM missions, Ethiopia, South Africa, we're involved in information sharing. We want migrants to realize the dangers of these irregular migration journeys. We also have a project in order to voluntarily return migrants to their home countries. We have returned over several hundred migrants who went to South Africa who did not find the opportunities that they were looking for and wanted to voluntarily return to their home country. So just from Mozambique, we've returned over 300 migrants, Mozambican migrants, in the past few years from South Africa.
And finally, in terms of COVID-19 preparedness, what can you tell us about the state of play in Mozambique at the moment? Many cases of infection?
There are a few cases of COVID-19 in Mozambique. This question is best placed for the World Health Organization, but all UN agencies are in support of the government of Mozambique, the Ministry of Health, and the World Health Organization to respond to this crisis.